Yo, what up? It's Eric, a.k.a. Movie Bass, a.k.a. Jazz.
Yo, what up? It's Jim, a.k.a. Jumpman, a.k.a. Auto Mechanic.
Internet! It's your boy Combat Jack. What's up, guys?
Yeah, and this is a waste of time, but this is the real. Yo, Combat Jack.
Yo, what's up?
Yo, you're really here in the building.
I'm in here in the flesh. You guys prepared such an amazing meal.
Thank you.
I'm full.
We made you some pasta, you know, bolognese sauce with a little, you know, onion and celery and carrot and parsley and whatever else.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And
asparagus on the side. And then
I bought you some cookies.
Yo, listen.
Yes. Made
not
by.
Just, not just some cookies.
Made These by your wife.
Made by Unbelievable
wife.
Kim.
Yo.
The bakery on Bergen. Let me get
just going to say, give me the address.
740 Bergen Street, right off of Washington Avenue.
What's Brooklyn, that train stop?
Brooklyn, New York. That's, I want to say it's Clinton, Washington.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. Off the sea.
Off the sea. Yo. There you go. You fucking guys are grilling me. So how do you guys like the cookies, man?
Yo, they're
amazing.
So good.
Good. So everybody's happy.
Yes. Listen, so far so good.
Yeah, you have been twice now the only person to bring us food on our podcast.
Really?
Which we appreciate.
These ungrateful bastards. Yeah. Who raised these guys?
Wouldn't you be surprised that the Migos didn't bring us anything?
The Migos didn't bring you anything?
No, they just brought us headaches.
Headaches, okay.
It's
good to be back here, man. It's really, really good to be back here.
You are.
And I think I sent you guys a note a couple of months ago. I really appreciate you guys. I really appreciate what you guys do.
Thank you.
And I mean that from the heart, man.
Well, the same goes from us to you. You are someone who every time we see you, it's all love.
Yes.
You're just a genuine soul, a good person. Yeah. And in this business, we really appreciate
that. Unless you want to start some beef.
Yo, I don't know.
let's get it popping.
Yo, let's get into it like at minute 40 so people listen to the whole thing. You have really like an amazing history. And I think what's cool is, look, we're two guys who, over the course of 8 years, our career, we've done a whole bunch of different things,
yes,
right?
You have.
And we made that move, honestly, just without regard for what people would think or
which is how you should do
or
it.
Or what your legacy would be.
What's always same here?
That's what I was gonna get to. Like, it's always impressed me that you're a lawyer, you have a family, you had a career that was not just like 1 year, 2 years, and you switched it up. This was like your job.
Yep.
This was your career. And then you were like, you know what? I'm not happy in this. I'm going to switch it up. But we'll get there.
Okay.
We'll get to that. But can we start from the beginning?
Let's start from the beginning.
You're born and bred in Brooklyn.
Born and bred in Brooklyn. First generation American.
What hospital?
Via, oh my God. You just caught me. Brookdale Hospital.
Off
Brookdale
the C train.
Hospital. I believe Brookdale Hospital is the birthplace of Mike Tyson and Michael Jordan.
No kidding.
Brookdale, yes.
I think that's a Biggie lyric.
I know, yeah.
Yeah. And I think the late, great Sean Price was also born in Brookdale.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And how many siblings you have?
I am an only child.
No kidding.
Yeah.
You were enough.
I was enough. Well, my mom had me, and then my mom and my dad were never married.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a lot of half siblings,
mm-hmm.
but I grew up the only child, which is actually kind of fun, man.
Yeah?
Yeah.
We don't know what that's like.
It was all mine.
No. Yeah.
I didn't have to share. So now having four kids is really bugged out. Like how I have to program myself to be as selfish as I am.
So did you when you decided to have kids, were you like one may be enough, or were you like, I want to have a brood?
I wanted two.
Yeah.
And then we had three. And then we had four. but my wife is so bad. So, you know?
Yeah. So
wait, growing up, did you ever want siblings?
There were a couple of times when I wanted siblings, but other than that, I was just so used to, you know, being into my own head, man, being into my own space, being free to be a nerd and grow up with hip hop and just the freedom, like of I was kind of like a latchkey kid because my mom worked, you know, 24/7. So, you know, other than the basics of like doing your schoolwork and being respectful, like I had free reign of like the home and the streets.
Yeah.
But I knew, like I knew at a young age what my boundaries were.
Okay.
And my boundaries were to never disappoint your mom. My mom.
That's pretty good. How were you at like jumping on the train and just going wherever you wanted?
So, yeah, I mean, but you got to think this is like late 70s,
right.
80s. So mm-hmm. we were really jumping on the train,
yeah.
you know, riding the outside of the
Did
train.
Did you really?
Yeah. And we would do stupid shit because we didn't have video games and stuff like that. I mean, New York was pretty lawless, so I remember me and my friends would travel to the Bronx just so that we could cross the elevated subway, like just the L, just across, like outside, like we would cross that shit a couple of times. And, you know, we didn't have a militarized police state at the time, so we just ran rampant.
Did you watch the documentary Rebel Kings on Netflix?
Amazing.
Amazing.
And I love documentaries like that because it really takes me back to my childhood in New York City. That's how it fucking was.
By the way, executive produced by Jim Carrey.
Okay. Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's about, I don't know if people know what it is. It's like about gangs in 1970s New York.
New York. There were a lot of gangs. It was really like the Warriors. If you guys don't know about the Warriors, you had gangs in every neighborhood. It wasn't just like Bloods and Crips.
No, it was like a block by block basis.
Yeah. It was very territorial, and you could find yourself fucked up on the wrong block.
Did you ever get in any trouble in the Bronx?
No, never. Like, I was in and out. And, you know, my friends and I were just nimble. We were very lucky.
Yeah.
We were very lucky not
to riding on the outside of trains, first of all.
But also, I mean, like, they're talking about in the documentary, and, I mean, maybe you can speak to this, even though you were in Brooklyn, but, like, how the cops couldn't even get into the Bronx because, like, when people would shoot and leave bodies in the streets, like, the bodies would be left there because people would then shoot the cops who went to go retrieve the bodies.
You know, I don't know.
And the ambulances.
I don't know much about that, but I do know the difference in policing is up until the late 80s, cops were very reactive.
Mm-hmm.
They waited for something to happen. And then there weren't a lot of cops on payroll anyway. New York was virtually bankrupt. And it wasn't until a cop got assassinated by the Supreme Team in Queens in the late 80s. That's what set off cops being so proactive.
Yeah.
And zero tolerance and broken windows policy and the whole nut.
Yeah.
I'm not a New York historian, by the way.
So did you grow up and go through, like, elementary, middle, and high school with the same crowd?
No. So my first through third grade, my school closed at the third grade.
Really?
Got sent to a different school from the fourth to the sixth grade. And then I got pulled out. I went to Catholic school all my life. A Catholic.
Same with us.
Yeah. Get out of here. You guys went to Catholic school?
No.
Fuck out of here. So I got sent to this really special school called Robert F. Kennedy Incentive Program in the Ridgewood section of Brooklyn. It's kind of like the border of Brooklyn and Queens.
Mm-hmm.
And they took, I guess, the brightest kids from, like, local Catholic schools. And it was like this kind of like makeshift private school. And what was awesome about it is, like, there was one sixth grade, one seventh grade, one eighth grade. The year I got there was the first year that they integrated girls into the program.
Hmm.
But the greatest thing is, like, we had a school trip every year in which we would travel to Europe.
Wow.
So in the seventh grade, we went to to Italy.
Really?
And that shit was, it was just, you know, being a city kid and then being exposed to Italy with your peers.
Oh, my God.
You know, and I just remember, like, my mom didn't come. It was optional for parents to come, but I would imagine that it was pretty costly. And to this day, I keep asking my peers, which one of us in the seventh grade snuck weed all the way to Italy? Because I remember just bawling in somebody's room, smoking some dirt weed, man, all the way from Brooklyn, you know, to Italiano style. So
it was Sean Price.
And then in the eighth grade, we traveled to Spain. And I think the amazing thing about traveling is when you really start seeing the differences in culture.
Yeah.
So when I went to Italy, I just remember one time watching the television. And there was a commercial, and this woman just went topless.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, shit. But it was nothing.
Right.
And that's when I realized that America might kind of be backwards in terms of, like, sexuality. And this is in the seventh grade. In the eighth grade, when we went to Spain, our teachers took us to a wine tasting tour.
Mm-hmm.
And we got fucked up. Like, we drank wine all day in the eighth grade.
Man.
And knowing that you can't do this, I was like, what's wrong with the States? The States is really backwards. So, you know, it's very important to travel. You guys know. It's really important to travel, particularly as kids, as children.
Yeah. Our eighth grade trip was to Washington.
Washington, D.C.?
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't hit, you know.
Yeah, we didn't get fucked up off wine or, no. You know.
didn't smoke that Chiba.
No.
Eighth grade, you're coming back from Italy and Spain. You come back with all this sort of worldly, you know, viewpoint at this point. What's high school like for you?
High school, I went to Xavier High School.
Okay.
In Chelsea. All
Go
male,
Tigers.
All male Jesuit, quasi-military.
Really?
And I made that choice, man. I had the option to go into different schools, but I was like, you know what? I like Xavier. It was a good, like, you know, prep school in terms of, like, the Catholic school system. Mm-hmm. And I kind of felt at the time that I wanted that discipline. I didn't want to be distracted by girls because I knew I could easily be distracted by girls. So sure. I really went for the discipline, and I really enjoyed it, man.
Okay. Were there dances that you would go to?
We had sister schools.
Okay.
And
because those Catholic girls...
Yeah, they're wild.
They're wild.
Because they don't know any better. They don't know what's on the outside.
They don't know any better. I remember making out in the lobby with this chick because I wanted to impress my boys. Dumb shit like that, man. But Xavier was cool. I mean, I think it, you know, I think...
Wait,
I've
were
always,
they impressed?
Huh?
Were your friends impressed?
She was kind of ugly, so I don't think they were. But, you know, you, the dumb shit you do when you're young.
Right.
But I've always been... just pretty focused on education.
Mm-hmm.
Just really, just that's, if anything, that's what my mom drilled down. And I always wanted to learn, man. I never wanted to be the dumb kid.
Yeah. Well, what did religion mean to you at that point?
Okay, so I come from the most Catholic family on the planet,
mm-hmm.
in which out of my five uncles, four of them were Catholic priests.
Wow.
And my two existing aunts are nuns.
Wow.
So I come from the most Catholic family. So in high school, you know, it started to dawn on me that growing up in such a religious household, it didn't mean anything to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I felt actually between high school and law school, I kind of felt spiritually lost. And I was actually searching for religion, like really hungering for spirituality in my life. And I had looked into the Nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, back in the late 80s, you know, Farrakhan, Public Enemy, that was some spirituality for your ass.
Yeah.
And the shit was dope. You know?
Yeah.
By the way, Eric is nodding like he also.
Eric's like, that's right.
Like, yeah. I wanted to be an M1.
But, you know, in my last year of law school, I encountered Buddhism. And that really, it fit like a glove. And I've been a practicing Buddhist now for, what, 26 years?
Really?
Yeah, and it's, you know, just really changed my life.
And I didn't know that, but that makes so much sense in thinking about, like, your demeanor, the whole thing. But back to high school for a second.
Yeah.
Like, so Catholic school, they drill that into you, right? I mean, that's part of your curriculum, your, like, the whole...
God and
sin
and Jesus died for our sins. And yeah, I guess so, but, you know, like, I think... In our school, as in most Catholic schools, at least from my experience, it's like those were the gut classes.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the classes you went and you kind of bullshitted your way through.
Mm-hmm.
And it was requisite courses because of these Catholic schools. But they weren't. It wasn't like, I mean, you know, I think what was really drilled down was discipline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, particularly in an all male school, particularly with, you know, I didn't know at the time, but we had some weirdo priests, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really just that whole disciplinarian thing, which I was actually seeking out.
And you're a better person because of the discipline.
I think I'm a better person because of that focus on education.
And when it came time to send your kids to school, were you like, they'll make the choice as to whether they want discipline or not?
So my wife, unbelievable Kim.
Yeah.
Follow her.
Yep.
She is an amazing private tutor.
Mm-hmm.
And she is actually one of the top, she's one of the most sought after private tutors in New York City.
Well, because she's making cookies for everybody.
she makes cookies for everyone, but that, you know, really, she actually grew up in the private school system.
Mm-hmm.
And she's really good at navigating students through that system, which I didn't know, you know, existed. To the point where some of these schools actually refer her to their students. And she, you know, she has some pretty impressive clients. I'll tell you guys off air.
Yeah, sure.
Who are clients.
Justine
Skye.
Yeah, no, I was going to say.
A friend
of the podcast.
She homeschooled Justine Skye. She also homeschooled this other band by the name of the Skins.
Okay.
They're signed to Rick Rubin's label. Oh, wow. And were managed by what's the Garnier guy from Entourage?
Adrian Grenier. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, no,
the,
sure.
The shampoo.
Yeah.
Fructose.
Yeah. Memphis Bleak.
So, you know, her thing was, you know, we got to get our kids into private school. And I was like, honey, we can't afford this. But she knows how to navigate her way through.
That's awesome.
Yeah. She's unbelievable.
Kim.
Yeah, we just don't know that, like, that private school life. Dude, like, you know?
it's so privileged.
Yeah.
It's, like, really privileged. Like,
right.
What's the admission process like?
You'd have to ask. Unbelievable, Kim.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just know on the first day that my sons walked in, they all got iPads.
Whoa.
And we're talking about four years ago, before I think that started becoming common practice
in
school.
Sure.
And you know, last year our kids, our two eldest sons flew to China with the school, and you know, so they're, you know, they've traveled.
Yeah.
It's just and you know.
Well, just like their father.
Yeah, just like their father. But it's amazing because the tuition overall is $40,000 a year per student.
Holy,
which is crazy.
That is crazy.
Crazy. So it's frightening to me now. You know, when you hear about this economic divide, this wealth gap,
the
erosion of the middle class, and then you see where, you know, my kids go to school with these one percenters.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, one percenters, and it's just really frightening how prepared these kids are for the future, and how unprepared most of these other kids. I don't want to make an assumption, but a lot of kids are unprepared for the future.
Yeah, man. Yeah, most definitely. So, getting to the end of high school.
Yeah,
where are you looking to go to school?
So. This is a great story, actually. So it was mid-80s, and I had an amazing art teacher by the name of Marilyn Minter.
Mm-hmm.
And Marilyn Minter was kind of like this punked, kind of like drugged out chick from like the downtown scene. But she really touched me with regard to artistry, and I, you know, got me open into like painting and drawing. And I knew at the time that I was going to be an artist,
mm-hmm.
a visual artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I, that was my favorite class. And at the time I didn't know, like, she was actually running with Basquiat.
Whoa,
wow.
And Warhol and that downtown crew.
Man.
Can I skip forward?
Please.
To how cool she was?
Yeah.
So, you know, she really inspired me to become an artist. I got into Cornell. She's like, the school sucks, but follow. But you got into Cornell. The fine arts program sucked.
Yeah.
But you're in Cornell right now.
You can get to that school of agriculture like real easy.
Yeah. And then, you know, when I got to Cornell, I just realized how the fine arts program really sucked.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I just did a 180 and I decided to go pre-law.
Yeah.
So I had a conversation with her at the time and she's like, you're giving up art? Like, you're a pussy. Like, you know, she went off on me. Hadn't seen her in years. And a couple of summers ago, I'm watching the debut of Jay-Z's Picasso Baby.
Yeah.
And she's in there.
Crazy.
Oh, whoa.
With Jay-Z with credits.
That's awesome.
With credits. So I recently hooked up with her. And she's this thriving artist now in her 70s. She, you know, recently did skateboard decks for Supreme.
Wow.
And she's got this ill retrospective going on right now about the Bush. And just bringing back women being very comfortable with their pubic hair.
Yeah.
And so with their pubic hair. And she's just a brilliant. And so we, you know, now that I kind of live this creative life.
Yeah.
She's really proud of me. But, and you know, I keep telling her, like, I'm so fucking proud. I never had a teacher that I was so fucking proud of.
Yo, I mean, obviously you know this, but that's not the average art teacher.
No. And so what's crazy, like, to wind this story up, is when I met her for the first time since high school 2 summers ago. I was like, Marilyn Minter, you were such, you know, an inspiration to me. And she's like, Reggie, half the time I was coming to class, I swear to God, I was high off crack.
Oh, my God.
I mean, but she kind of had to get blazed to come into this, like, tight Jesuit.
Yeah.
And at the time, I didn't know the shit was perverted, but she kind of knew.
Sure.
And I don't want to shit on Xavier, but
yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, the Yeah.
And also that's like a day job, and she's hanging out with, like, you know, the coolest artists around.
Coolest artists of the time.
Fab Five Freddy really excuse crack. No, yeah, I feel like we're all making a lot of excuses for crack.
I think everyone kind of smoked crack in the mid 80s.
Yeah, but it's always been whack, right?
Crack is whack.
Yeah. two things. Yeah. One is we were on your show. I want to say, well, we've been on the show a few times, but when we put out our mixtape Urbane Outfitters Volume 1 with DJ Drama, we came on and we played you a couple tracks, one of which was our song with Bun B called Girls with the Dirty Souths. And we salute those women who let the bush grow.
Yes,
we're on the same wavelength.
Yeah, you got to see our artwork.
That's really awesome. Second thing is, Jeff was class artist his senior year of high school.
Sure was.
Your art teachers, with all due respect, were definitely not on the same level, right?
No, but she was definitely on crack. Okay. So.
She was on crack. She wasn't hanging out with Basquiat.
No, it's a little further. She was coming in from Westchester.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you win any awards in high school?
No.
Like in the yearbook?
No, I just kept it real low. I remember my theater. The guy that ran theater was trying to get me to join theater, and I was like, I'm not fucking, because I just really loved my freedom.
I wasn't
part of any athletics. I'd go to school, I'd do my schoolwork, and then I'd go home.
Yeah.
And hang out with my friends on my block. And I remember in my senior year, Father Sullivan pressured my mother to pressure me to join drama.
Really?
And I was like, fuck you, this is fucked up, I don't want to do this shit. And I had the best time.
Oh.
I just really had the best time.
So he saw something in you?
He saw something in me. And I think, you know, I was always destined to do something creative, something vocal, something expressive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I made that shift to become a lawyer, it just all got stifled.
Well, so what brings you to Cornell, to upstate? Like, are you looking for an Ivy League school?
I got into Cornell.
Did you look in any other places?
I you know, it's really fucked up, man. I had my guidance counselor, Father McGowan.
Mm-hmm.
I realized later on in life that I think he was racist.
Really?
Because, or just biased, or whatever the fuck you want to call it. Because I remember at the time wanting my first choice, because just of my friends talking about it, I really wanted to go to Syracuse. And he was like, Syracuse is beyond your reach, but you should really aim for Howard. Now, I have nothing against Howard, but I was like, okay. And I really believed him.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got accepted to Cornell, I didn't realize it until a year later. He was really pissed off.
Really?
He was not encouraging at all. He was really pissed off. And it wasn't until when I was at Cornell, some other kids came up to visit, and they were like, yeah, Father McGowan was talking about how some bozo got into Cornell.
That's horrible.
So if he had a shot, then they had a shot.
As I'm a Syracuse graduate. Yeah. Cornell is far beyond.
Syracuse had the girls.
No, it did.
And
it
the
did.
Parties. And was it Sky Barn?
Sky
Barn, right?
Yeah, Carrier Dome, like all that. Yes, like it was just, it was a great time. We had one quad. You guys had like eight, right?
Yes.
Huge campus.
Huge campus.
Ithaca is gorgeous. Yeah. but like, honestly, for an education, like, it's Ivy League. I mean, it's world renowned.
Yeah.
Far beyond. So fuck Father, whatever his name is.
McGowan.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
And I hope
Father McGowan is a listener of this podcast.
Well,
and
Father
I wish that you
McGowan
guys wouldn't.
Actually passed on.
Oh, did he really?
And I remember some students, like some alum were like, we ran into some alum like, yo, did you hear that Father McGowan passed away? And I was kind of dry. I was like, yo, fuck him. And they all looked at me like I was like a, you know, blasphemy. But like, fuck him. Like, fuck him.
Yeah.
For trying to do that to my dream.
No, that's fucked up.
Wait, question. So the Pope comes to town.
Yeah.
Recently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You grew up Catholic. What are your thoughts on the Pope coming to town? Did you care at all?
I didn't care at all.
Our mom cared so much.
Really?
Yeah.
My mom cared so much.
Our mom, yeah, but
my family cared so much.
But our
yes,
moms,
but they
like,
are Catholic. Our mom.
Our mom's a Jewish woman who was just.
But he's
like,
a rock. He's like a religious rock star.
He is.
He's a religious rock
Time
star.
Time Warner had that like 24-hour channel, and she was just glued to it.
Yep.
Yeah. Like, I mean, our mom was watching the Pope on mute.
for what it's worth, this guy is very progressive.
Sure.
From what I understand,
yeah,
and is actually softening I guess, some of the views that the Catholic Church has had on a lot of issues. So,
listen, our mom just like seeing him in the Popemobile going through Central Park. You know,
looking like, did you see the one image where he looked like he was about to drop the illest mixtape?
Oh, yeah. The shot with Obama,
too? Back to back.
Yeah. So, okay, so you go up to school at Cornell.
Yeah.
What are you expecting to do up there?
I'm expecting to learn.
Okay.
And so I guess the disconnect was my first semester in fine arts, I was not learning anything.
What kind of roommate did you have?
I had a really nerdy roommate, and we got into an altercation, and we had to draw straws as to who was going to move out, and he had to move out. So my freshman year, I guess 3-4 months into my freshman year, I had a double.
That's dope.
Which was dope. Dope.
Good choice against the altercation.
Yeah, did you rig that straw process?
No, I didn't. I was like,
straw pole.
Does that mean he had to move in with two other dudes and like they had a triple in what should have been a double?
I don't give a fuck where he had to move, but I had a double and it was popping.
What was the altercation over?
So he was, I guess, from the Midwest. I'm a city kid.
Yeah, yeah.
I like to hang out. He was tight. And then he had some kind of like medical issues also. So he was just like, just annoyed all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a girlfriend. Yeah. And it was just like, yo, like, we're not getting along at all.
Yeah.
So we brought it to the art. I mean, it wasn't like any type of fist fight.
Right. Yeah,
physical,
right.
But
because he didn't want it.
Well, he also couldn't handle it. He had a medical issue.
He had a medical issue. Yeah. So I didn't want to like sock him and his neck twist to the side or some shit. So we so we spoke to our RA, man, and they resolved it that way, man. And you know, I got the room.
Yeah. And
but going back to your question,
yes,
I felt that like I saw my peers that were like in engineering and agriculture and medicine and pre-law. I saw their minds being challenged, and I'm sitting in these classes with these trust fund kids,
yeah,
like smelling like fucking glue and and clay and paint, and I was like, you know what, I felt that I had to soak up, like I swear at that young age I was like, I have to come here and soak up some education.
Did your parents have any expectations on what you should do with your career?
First generation American, first to go to college. My parents were like, you go to college.
That's it.
Like, we don't know, you know. So I was pretty aimless. I didn't have any aim. I didn't have any guidance.
Yeah.
Yeah, fuck Father McGowan.
Fuck Father McGowan. And then I happened to come home one day during break, and I saw one of my cousins who was a Park Avenue attorney at the time. I saw his pay stub, and I was like, fuck it, I'm going to law school.
Whoa. Did you have the idea, too, that you were going to, like, law school means another 3 years?
Yes.
And you were, like, totally for it?
I was like, I want that check.
Yeah.
I want
and whatever
check.
It takes to get there, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So you decide that like freshman year?
Freshman year. Wow. After my first semester.
Wow.
And I decided to transfer, and it was painful. It was so fucking painful. Just getting acclimated to the coursework. And, you know, I'm now in, I totally skipped like the 101s. I'm in statistics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 102 and econ and all of this shit. And I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
I'm not ready for this shit. So I actually almost failed out.
Well, you're going from left brain all the way to right
brain. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it was like, but I persevered.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some good friends who had some great study habits. And I just really adapted to what they were doing so that by junior year, I had a hang of it. And then by senior year, I was soaring.
That's dope.
Yeah.
How are you getting up and back to Ithaca?
We'd rent a car.
Okay.
And, you know, just, you know, we'd all chip in and rent a car.
And drive
back and forth. And,
yeah.
But Ithaca's beautiful, man. And coming from New York, I mean, we're in New York State.
Yeah.
Right.
We're 4 hours away.
Yep.
But New York is still accessible. It's still New York. So, and at the time, Cornell had a really strong inner city recruitment program. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of kids from Brooklyn, a lot of kids from Harlem, a lot of kids. So we had our community that I was able to identify with and not get swallowed up into the general greater Cornell population.
Did you ever make any trips out of the colleges like while at school? Were you guys road tripping?
We used to go to Syracuse.
Yeah, oh, okay, yeah.
Syracuse had the babes, man. Syracuse had the women and the parties. But, you know, Binghamton, Buffalo, Utica, whole up
there. Yeah.
Sounds so glamorous.
It wasn't, but it was fun, man. You know, upstate in the winters are just harsh.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just loved being away from New York at the time. And that's when I was in college, was really when the crack epidemic was starting to hit.
Yeah.
So every time I would come back to Brooklyn, shit would shift. Like, I was like, why are my friends on the corner right now?
Yeah.
Like, why are my friends that I grew up with, that we played with G.I. Joes and Matchboxes, why are they on the corner? And, whoa, why are they carrying guns?
Yeah.
And I'd go back to school and come back and like, wait, who are those 20 other motherfuckers that are on the corner? So I grew up in the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn, on Lincoln Place between Albany and the legendary Troy Avenue.
Yep.
Like, mm-hmm. I grew up on Troy Avenue.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
I understand what Troy Ave is trying to emulate by, because that was like a main vein of the crack trade back in the day.
Yeah.
In
yeah. Yeah. So you come back and everything's changed.
A lot.
And
a lot.
How do you associate with the same guys you grew up with?
Loose. Like, you know, some kids were, not every kid was a hustler.
Right.
But, you know, the ones that were destined to be hustlers were hustlers. And I stayed cool with everybody. But I didn't stay on the block, because now, you know, I'm in college. I'm coming back. And I'm starting to discover the New York nightlife, the New York club scene, which is all in Manhattan.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all in Manhattan. The Paradise Garage and just, you know, Bentley's and all these other legendary clubs that existed in New York at the time. So I barely stayed in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You know, I did all my hanging out in the city.
Yeah.
Is it weird to see, like, the shift, like, that Brooklyn is going through now, where it's just, like, I mean, I'm sure it is. I already know the answer to this question. but, I mean, like, I guess talk about what it was like, you know, to see Brooklyn.
So my wife is really happy about all this, you know, aggressive gentrification going on, because she's like, we miss growing up. My wife's also a native Brooklynite. She's like, we miss being able to hang out in Brooklyn.
Right.
Whereas our kids, my eldest son is 18. I have my other son is 17, and my youngest son is 13. They never had a fight in their lives. I don't know if that's rare to you, but to me, it's like they never had a fight.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. And they hang out with their friends, and they have a cool crew, and there's like all these cool spots right now, and it's safe, and I actually feel a lot safer with my kids going out, hanging out in New York, in Manhattan or Brooklyn or whatever. I feel safe for the most part, where, you know, back then it was not safe.
Yep.
So pardon me, I do embrace that aspect of the change in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But then with that, I'm really worried about, you know, my kids now. To me, they're still babies, but they don't look like babies. They're, my 13-year-old is, what, 6'1"? And he looks like a black man. And it's like, to me, he's a baby, and it breaks my heart that at any given moment, a cop might stop him and ask him to identify himself, which has happened, actually.
Really?
Yeah. So he goes to private school, and, you know, the days that public schools are in session, and private schools aren't, and they see him walking around, and they don't assume that he goes to private school.
So what was that conversation like with him?
That conversation we've been having that conversation with our kids since, like, they're fighting over, like, some stupid toy at 3 or 4, and, like, this is not fair, like, life's not fair. And so we drilled that into our kids at an early age.
Yeah.
We're really progressive about not shying away from that issue.
Yeah. So you coming back to a city that's changed, you're on your way through college, you know you're going to law school.
No, I'm going to law school.
Where are you looking at law school?
So I got the notion, and this is a great story.
Yeah.
This is a fucking great story. So at the time, I read somewhere that the top school, law school, was Georgetown.
Okay.
So I was like, fuck it. I'm going to Georgetown.
Right.
You wanted sports.
I wanted the number one spot.
Yeah.
For what I was just aggressive like that.
Yeah.
And just aggressive, and once again, not, you know, no guidance, but just really moving on, you know, what I'm hearing and impression, and like, if I'm going to law school, I might as well go to the number, and at the time the Hoyas were.
Yeah, sure.
Fucking amazing.
Yeah.
You know, so so I applied to Georgetown, applied to some other safe schools also. I got into all the other safe schools. I didn't get into Brooklyn Law.
Really?
I didn't get into Brooklyn Law. But I got waitlisted for Georgetown. And I didn't know what that meant. I thought that was like, you're in, but you're not in, but you're in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my uncivilized ass, I just started picking up the phone and harassing the dean of students. Like, dude, I got to get in.
Yeah.
Dude, I got to get in. So I'm doing this all throughout my last semester of law school. I don't, fuck it, I'll tell the story. So, so I'm riding through the summer and I'm like, you know what? If I don't get into Georgetown, I'm gonna put all these other schools on pause. I'm gonna work the year and just take the LSATs again and reapply. So it's fucking the first week in August. I'm at this nightclub called the Paradise Garage, mm-hmm. which was a nightclub that opened its doors at midnight and closed its doors at noon. So it was like just this is New York in the 80s.
Yeah.
And so they didn't have a liquor license, but it was a open air club with regard to whatever else you could bring in there. Yeah. So I am specifically tripping off of mescaline. Like I'm tripping, I'm fucking seeing lights and I'm tripping. And yeah. It's just like, and it's, so I run into my high school friend,
Father McGowan.
No, not fuck Father McGowan. Run into my high school friend, Sam Galloway. And Sam is with his girlfriend from Connecticut. And he's like, yo, Reg, he's in the garage. His girlfriend is in the garage. It's like 4 a.m. I'm tripping. I'm tripping. He's like, yo, what are you doing next year? And I was like, he decided he was going to be a state trooper.
Okay.
And I was like, dude, I'm trying to get into law school. I'm trying to get into Georgetown. These motherfuckers don't want me to live. I can't not let me live. I'm on this wait. I'm trying to. So his girl says, wait a minute. My aunt dates the dean of students. And then I fucking sobered up and I was like, get the fuck out of here. So this is Friday night, Saturday morning. Sunday night, I'm on the phone with her aunt. Monday, I'm on the phone with the dean of students.
Are you on mescaline still?
Friday, I drive down to Georgetown. We have an interview. He shakes my hand. That following Monday, Western Union, I'm in Georgetown.
Yo.
2 weeks before classes start. Now,
that's awesome.
Now, what's really awesome is this dean took a big risk with me. And okay. then he hadn't heard of me since I graduated from high school. I'm jumping around now. Last June, I got tapped to give the keynote speech at the Howard Law School commencement ceremony. And as I'm walking in, I bump into my dean. And he's like, hey, what are you? And I'm in like full regalia and the whole nine. He's like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, oh, my God. So I get up on stage to give this speech. And I was like, not only do I have to inspire the students, but I really want to show this guy that he really made the right choice. Like he didn't fuck up that one gamble.
Yeah.
And then we just connected after that. He was like, dude, you blew me away. This was amazing.
That's incredible.
And so now one of, I think his son-in-law, he's trying to get into music, and he's like, can you look out for my son-in-law? So I've been. So
it's and you just, said no.
No. He's been to the Combat Jack Show studio, and it's just that whole concept of paying it forward and then paying it back.
Yeah. I totally, totally subscribe to that. And also, like, how about just the sort of serendipity of you running into your dude and his girls there and, like, all this sort of comes together?
I totally believe in the power of determination, man. Like, if you are determined to do something, like, shit just the universe conspires on your behalf to make that shit happen because I've witnessed it time and time and time again.
Here's something we really want you to retell because you told us this. I think it's early in your law career.
Yeah.
Can you tell the story about the sauna?
Diddy.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Diddy's ice cold, man. Like Diddy's the best that ever did it. I think for my generation, Diddy's the best that ever did it.
Yeah.
For so many different reasons, but I remember my partner at the time, Ed Woods. We kept trying to have a meeting with Puff. Now we knew Puff's attorney. We knew that we didn't have a shot at representing Puff, but we just wanted to get in that circle. And here's this young black guy. Here's these young black attorneys. We're in the same clubs. He sees us. We see him. We're at the same parties. It's like, yo, Puff, just throw us one of your clients, man. Can we get Big? Can we get Craig Mack? Can we get Mace? We wanted to be in that universe. So we'd been chasing Puff down for like about 6 months. And finally he's like, all right, fuck it. Meet me at the 10th Street bathhouse. Are you guys familiar with the bathhouse?
No.
It's this Turkish bathhouse.
It's like the Sky Barn in
Syracuse. No, it's not like the Sky Barn. It's this old, it looks like a dungeon. and it's got these old Hasidics in there. And then, but it, at the time, it was really cool because Russell would hang out there, and Andre Harrell, you know, hence Puff, and LL Cool J, and John Amos, and it was just like this, and actually the late JFK Jr. Like, it was just this real cool place, and it's still one of the few remaining gems in New York City.
It's still there.
It's still there, and it's great massages, great schwitzes. It's just it's ill. It's ill, and it's still relatively affordable.
And, so yeah. Anyone can go there.
Anyone can go there. Okay. You can just get up there and go there, and you know, I think it's like $40 for general access, and then a different pay schedule for a fee for a massage, but it's still there.
Yeah, by the way, this podcast is now sponsored by
Temp Street Turkish Bathhouse. So anyway, so we're in there, like we go in there, me and my former partner, and so there's this one big ass room called the Radiant Room. And it's like the biggest room in there. It's like the main attraction, and these fucking guys are in there whipping other people with like with grape leaves or some shit like that. It's just you know, it's just crazy. Yeah.
You were not high on mescaline.
It was all
this
sweated
is like a
out.
Bacchanal.
But it's so fucking hot in there. So Puff decides he wants us to meet him in the hottest fucking room. And he, you know, Puff, when you're talking to Puff, he mumbles and you can't hear him. So it's this steam going on. It's fucking torture. And he's like, yeah. So we're leaning into him. And the shit was torturous. And me and Ed were like, yo, whatever we do, don't run out. Whatever you do, show Puff you could stand
stick it
that
out.
Heat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yo, 5 minutes in, I run out. It's too fucking hot. I run in. Ed Woods is running out. And fucking Puff is cool as a fan. And I think he was really fucking with us. But we rode it through. And then that really, really began the beginning of a great relationship. Man.
So from there, you link up with the Hitmen.
The Hitmen. Well, we had Derek Angeletti and Ron Lawrence. But then we get Nasheem Merrick and, you know, Harf Pierre, which is Puff's right-hand man for forever. And Puff referred a young Stevie J to us. And Mario Winans. And just that whole...
You got the whole roster.
We had the whole roster.
Yeah.
Which was an amazing, amazing run. Just like, you know, being in the studio and watching Big perform, you know, record Hypnotize.
Ugh.
You know, just
did you know Biggie from Brooklyn at all?
I didn't know Biggie at all from Brooklyn. I knew Biggie from Puff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was one of those, we were one of those early cats that received like the early pre like album cassette of Ready to Die, and we were like, oh shit, like it's,
you should leak that. Yeah.
Well, how do you, well, anyway.
Dub it or something.
Yeah.
Wait, how do you get into entertainment law in the first place? Like, why are you doing that and you're not doing
it's
like
all serendipity?
Okay.
It's all serendipitous. So my cousin, whose check I saw, worked at the Park Avenue firm while I was in law school, he became the general manager for Andre Harrell's fledgling Uptown.
Dope.
And so I didn't know what that meant. I didn't think the music industry was real. You know, you saw Russell Simmons from afar building this Def Jam empire, but I didn't know what the fuck Uptown was. So I was like, yeah, whatever. You're starting a label. Cool. So I remember being in school in at Georgetown and watching some video show and watching I'll Be Sure.
Yeah.
Performing his video Day and Night on the city rooftops. And I was like, that's Uptown Records. Oh, shit, that's real. So one thing I have a great knack for being is I can be a fucking pest. I can stalk the shit out of
you. And Diddy.
Me and Diddy, yeah. So I started pestering the shit out of my cousin. Like, dude, get me in. Dude, get me in. Dude, get me in. Dude, get me in.
Yeah.
And, like, the dude was ducking me. He was not returning my calls, but... the summer that I graduated from law school, one day he called me. He was like, yo, I think there's an opening for an intern in the legal department at Def Jam. And I was like, fuck. And then that changed my whole fucking life, man.
Amazing.
So we had Clark Kent on the podcast.
Yes. Super DJ Clark Kent.
Yes.
Who gave
like some crazy stories. Mm-hmm. But I looked online after the episode came out and I was like, thinking like, oh, nobody's ever told these stories before, and then I saw that you had told a bunch of the stories.
Okay.
On Complex. So like, you know, you were around for the Shine story.
Yes. When I made the Shine story happen.
You did.
I made, well, I was
when he got signed.
Right.
Right, because there's a second story that Clark told about the mixtape being thrown out the window.
I don't remember that one.
It's when he...
Clark introduced...
Yeah, he played Shine's music. Or, yeah.
Yeah, his demo for Jay.
Right.
And Shine left, and they started driving off, and he took this. Jay took the CD and chucked it out the window.
Really?
Yeah. And apparently he was rhyming over all of Jay-Z instrumentals.
Well, it's kind of ill because Clark referred Shine to me. And I remember being in the office one day, like early in the morning, and fucking Shine calls. And he's like, no, I was referred to you by Clark, and he starts rhyming. So what's weird is, initially, he had the same cadence as Jay-Z.
Yeah.
But he sounded like Biggie.
He didn't sound like Biggie yet. To me, my first listening to Shine,
yeah,
he sounded like Jay.
Crazy.
And then the next time I heard him, he sounded like Big. So I was like, you're like this fucking...
Cypher.
Chameleon. Yeah.
Did you get a lot of referrals like soon after you started? Were people like hungry and looking like just for any
in? We got a lot of referrals, and I think that's based on the fact that we were of like, so coming into the music industry in 1989 as a young attorney, like Harry Allen dubbed me like ground zero, like the hip hop attorney. Because I grew up in that culture.
Yeah.
I knew the culture. So being around all these creatives who were like, he gets the music, he's in the clubs, he's in the studios.
He's on mescaline. Yeah.
No, the mescaline thing, that was before, man. Don't do that. Don't do that, man. But, you know, they just felt comfortable, and we spoke the same language, and we were learning all this legalese and what the deals were at the same time. So it was kind of like a coming of age for that class.
Yeah.
That hip-hop class of, like, 90. So Damon, like Clark brought us Damon, who, you know, had been my client way before he started running with Jay-Z. And Ski Beats and once again, Ron Lawrence and Derek Angeletti, Two Kings and a Cypher. I did that. That was like my first rap deal. So like seeing this emerging business and being around all these people that would eventually become something in the industry was crazy, man. A special time.
And you would run into everyone like late at night at the club, like,
dude, I remember running into Tupac on Broadway. Like, it was just, you'd see, it didn't even have to be at night.
Was he in Cats?
No, he was not in Cats. He was with the Late Stretch, and they were just running around, eating hot dog, you know, from the carts, and you'd see everyone.
Yeah.
And the hottest place, though, I guess Ground Zero was like the hottest place, was in front of the Universal Building, which was at the time, I think, Uptown. And Puff was always out there. And Puff always had that energy. Even before he popped, he always had that energy. So you'd always want to see what was going on in front of the Universal Building.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With the Universal Building on like
57th and Broadway.
It's always weird to me that like clubs used to like exist in Midtown. Like that Midtown used to be cool.
Yeah. Well, Midtown was cool, but Downtown was always the coolest.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
Downtown was really,
but like Studio 54 was.
But Studio 54,
not that it was like a cool place.
It wasn't.
But
cool.
It was just that
it was established.
Cool. Yeah.
It was Times Square of today.
Yes.
You know, but Downtown was always the cool spots, man.
Yeah. But you became the guy.
We became at the time.
Or the guys.
Well, we were the guys because we were actually challenging the power structure at the time.
You know,
the state Jewish firms that had, you know, a chokehold on the industry, and all of a sudden, who these young black hip hop kids who had the credentials and had the clients. So,
right.
I mean, I told this story years ago about how I got into a shouting match with Lior over Clark Kent, and he said some crazy shit like, "You don't know who I am. I could fucking erase you from this business." Like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a gut reaction. And after I hung up, I was like, fuck.
Yeah.
I fucked up my career. Because Lior, you know, you don't fuck with Lior.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then a couple months later, we happened to pick up this new MC by the name of DMX.
Yeah.
And Lior is calling us like, dude, I made a mistake. Can we come and sit down and break bread? And it's crazy, man. Just the leverage that we had without even knowing that we had that leverage.
Well, wait, first. So all these rappers will talk about, like, they'll brag about having Jewish lawyers.
Yes.
Does that ever bother you, being a Haitian American?
you know, some initially it did, yeah. and then it became cliche. But sometimes I'd hear that, and I'd be like, "Yo, dude, like, we're commanding a good percentage of these deals out in New York City. What the fuck are you guys talking about?"
Yeah.
But I mean,
did you ever consider switching to Judaism?
No, because I was
yeah, yeah.
I'm a happy Buddhist.
Going back to like the college thing, when you switched up and you're like, you know, the arts, I'm gonna put that off, and I'm gonna get into like.
This whole other, and this is, where this is where the discipline comes in again.
Yeah.
This is where the discipline comes in about this shit is impossible. This shit is crazy, but I could hunker down and just.
But just, do you get that creative release from being in the music industry now and being around the J's and the Ski Beats and the DMX's and all that?
I thought I was.
Even at the time, though?
I thought I was, but.
Until you weren't.
I was still miserable.
Right.
Because. You know, developing what is the legal is the right side.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Developing that, I remember just my brain and my thought pattern shifting in law school, and just never loved the whole delving into contracts. I never loved the whole negotiations because to me it was just, you know, unless you had certain attorneys where you had kind of like a rhythm with,
mm-hmm.
I just hated that combative. I hated like the whole reptilian aspect of like, I'm going to fuck you over.
Right.
Or you're going to fuck me over.
Right.
And then as the stakes got higher, as our clients became people that commanded amazing deals, I just hated that pressure.
Yeah.
And one of the, you know, I lost Jay-Z early on in his career. Actually, we had been running around with Jay-Z for about 4 or 5 years, knocking on every door. I remember when Lior said no. I remember when everyone in the industry said no. We did the reasonable doubt deal with penalty. He popped, and I lost him as a client. So that killed my fucking confidence.
Yeah.
It killed my confidence. So I got real nervous with developing clients 4 or 5 years into the game, and when they popped, it was like, oh, shit, are they still my client? Like, I developed that kind of like, I don't know, it was just fucked up. My confidence was fucked up, and I wasn't happy.
Yeah.
Like, I was making money. I was doing these great deals, and it, at the time, it was easy to get a deal. Like we did deals with bum rappers every fucking day.
Right,
20,000-30,000 coming in like every other week, every other month.
Yeah,
but it was like I just got tired of that shit, and I felt that at any given point, I would be exposed for being a fraud. That's how.
But isn't that how everybody feels about everything? I feel like everybody has that feeling of like being exposed.
You know, it's so
the fear of being exposed.
It's so crazy because what I do right now, I think it really just comes so natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not about the hype, but I feel I don't think I'm the best interviewer at all. But I feel what I do, I'm the best at what I do, and I can really say that without the hype, with confidence.
Yeah.
And my interviews are so honest.
Yep.
That how can I be a fraud?
Well, first of all, our interviews are so good.
Yeah, you guys are so fucking hot.
Yo, but before we pivot to that,
I'm sorry.
Can you give us one good DMX story?
Can you give us 12 good DMX stories?
I mean DMX would knock Def Jam execs out. Like he was unstable, you know, but then you'd sit with DMX. And he would just philosophize about shit. And I'm like, this dude is like fucking, like he's blessed. Like he had this incredible energy. I don't have a specific DMX story. It's just like once he got on a roll talking, like he you could tell that he, you know, there was talks back then that he wanted to become a reverend or a preacher.
Yep.
He had that. He had that charisma. Like DMX, if you can remember or imagine, DMX was so hot that he was the only artist that Jay-Z stayed out of his, like he always gave, he made sure to kiss DMX's ring because DMX was that red hot.
Until he was president and then he was able to ax him.
So. Yeah, but he was president and at that time DMX was on the decline as
well. So you knew D and Y back then?
Yes.
And what were they like sort of early Rough Riders era?
Don't fuck with them. Like they were very serious about their business. They had this kind of like militant black Muslim type of, I guess, sheen to them.
Mm-hmm.
But they were about their business.
Yeah.
You know, they were about their business. And they just came in from nowhere. Just like Rough Riders, we're going to change this whole shiny suit sensibility.
Yeah.
And here comes fucking X with bad tattoos and the fucking dog chain, followed by Eve. And it was just a whole...
Did you wear shiny suits?
Yeah. Fuck yeah.
Where'd you get them from?
57th Street, like there were all these men.
Telling you, 57th Street's popping.
57th Street is popping. All these gaudy men's suit shops. Mm-hmm. Go in. This is crazy, man. With the big shoulders.
I used to wear my bar mitzvah jacket inside out.
Really?
Oh. It had the satin inside.
Was it crisscross?
Oh. Yo, something like that.
Crisscross era? Or?
It was lit.
It was lit.
Yeah, it was lit. Yeah. So, wait, I wanted. Can you tell Theta's story?
I barely remember it. Do you remember Theta Sandiford? She used to work at Def Jam and like on the digital side.
I remember her name. I remember her and I remember her name, but I don't remember.
Yeah. She took us out one time and she was like, oh man, I have a crazy DMX story. DMX was doing a music video and he wasn't showing up, right? And so like hours go by and at a certain point, Lior has to go up to his house in Yonkers to go get him.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the specifics, but I do remember that Lior had to contend with DMX's dogs, mm-hmm. to the point that DMX's dogs ended up going to the video shoot with DMX,
right.
and Lior.
Yeah.
I think I remember hearing something like that.
Okay.
Look, DMX was really attached to his dogs.
Yo. Right?
Apparently.
I mean, yeah. He needed them at the shoot.
One Love Boomer.
And
right?
Then there's no one like him, by the way.
No,
like,
no
that's,
one like him.
That's, I think, that's what's amazing about
him. I interviewed him once, and I started talking to him about, like, he used to drive through Harrison in Westchester, which is our town, and he would get pulled over, and he would then have to go to the court, which is where everybody in my high school would, like, you know, ditch class and go see DMX in court.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
That was, like a pastime,
yeah, yeah.
Let's go see DMX
It's like,
in
yo,
court.
You know he's going to get pulled
every,
over.
Every
like,
couple
he
weeks.
Just, it's like, he's driving without a license. Like, it's bound to happen.
Yo,
like,
DMX was one of the greatest, man.
Yeah.
You know?
So, okay. Everyone knows, I think at this point, your switch over to podcasting,
yep.
and the road that you have traveled and how really legendary in podcasting you have made things,
you
right?
You think so?
I do. Okay. I do. I think you've really made your mark.
Thank
I think
you.
Longevity, consistency, level of guests, and the conversations. I think
Thank
all
you,
those
man.
Things together
yeah,
are pretty epic. I want to know what it's like to have Damon Dash, to have Wah come back. They see you now and they're just like, oh my God, it's Reggie, but it's Combat Jack.
Right.
What's that like after all these years to have him come back in your life and have a conversation?
It's like a reunion, man. It's definitely like a reunion. You know, particularly with Damon Dash, like our relationship has been hot and cold. But, you know, knowing Damon and seeing that look in his face, like, yeah, I'm proud of what you're doing.
That's great.
You know, and knowing full well, knowing Damon, knowing to get out of his way, you know, as opposed to going, because I don't think anyone could go head on with Damon.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear an argument between Damon and Star. Like, that's what I want to hear. I would pay good money to see both
right,
of them
right.
argue over a point. But, like, you get out of their way. And then, you know, just it's kind of respectful. I think what I do is there's a recognition. And it's really just it's like I said, it's a reunion. It's like a conversation. It's not an interview.
Yeah,
we're going over memories. I mean, I do have my questions, but it's kind of like a cheat code, man.
Yeah,
it really.
How
is
do you
a cheat
prep
code.
For an interview?
I prep like
yeah.
crazy. So I just interviewed Norman Lear.
Yep.
And the last thing that he wrote was a 700-page. Autobiography.
Wow.
And so I read it. I read the whole thing from cover to cover, and then I started looking for interviews. And
well, how long before before actually interviewing him did you line it up?
That was lined up a couple of months ago, so I was able, but I procrastinated until the week before and then read it. So like I read everything that I can, particularly if it's their memoirs. You know, Daryl Strawberry came through. I read the book. Luke Can't, I read, you know, and I think this discipline comes once again from law school. And
sure.
then I just look at every angle. I look at other interviews. I try to see, I don't try to go over the same questions, but I kind of try to go into the spaces where those questions were left.
Yeah.
Right, if you can understand.
Sure.
It's like preparing for battle in a sense.
Yeah.
And I kind of want to bring old points, you know, go into new points. And so it's, I sequester myself. I'm like, I tell my wife I don't want to be fucked with.
Yeah.
You tell my team.
Yeah.
Like, don't call me during the day that I'm preparing. And I just really immerse myself in that world.
How did Dallas Penn used to prepare for an interview?
Dallas was brilliant, so I don't think Dallas ever prepared. Dallas was just, you know, he was just...
How did you guys connect?
Dallas, okay, so I loved Dallas's blog.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. During the great hip-hop blog renaissance.
Yeah.
Of what, 05, 06?
Yep, yeah.
So I was a fan of Dallas Penn's, and Dallas Penn was a fan of my blog at the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know... No one knew how I looked, but I knew how Dallas looked. So I remember being...
Well, Dallas has quite a look.
Yeah, and he was really, you know, open with putting his images up on his blog at the time. So I remember being at a party, and I was clean. It was my wife and I. It was a friend of ours, Rachel Goldstein. It was her birthday. And so in the back was the VIP, so we were walking in the back. But in the front, it was just like the regular cats. It was the... I forget the bar at the time. They just closed it recently. Anyway, so I'm clean. I come in with my wife, and I see Dallas at the bar. And I'm like, I know who you are. And he's like, well, who the fuck are you? And I'm like, excuse me. And I just go into VIP.
Yo.
Come back. He's still out there. I'm like, dude, I know who the fuck you are. He's like, so he just gives me this weird look. And I keep like fucking with him, keep going into the VIP where he has no access. And I think maybe the third or fourth time, I was like, yo, Dallas Penn Combat Jack. And he was like, oh shit, let me get the digits, blah blah blah. So we exchange numbers, and I think it's the very next week the motherfucker calls me at midnight. And in my he wakes up the whole fucking household. Yeah. I'm like, yo, I'm gonna have to curve this guy because this guy is weird,
right?
But we just start building. And if it weren't for Dallas Penn, I wouldn't have the Combat Jack Show. Because A King, our producer, was a programming director at
PNC.
PNC,
mm-hmm. yep.
Now defunct PNC Radio,
okay.
online radio station. Yep. And he approached Dallas Penn to do an online radio show. Dallas was like, yo, Reg, do you want to do this radio show? I was like, I sat on the fences for a while. And finally, I was like, fuck it, let's do it. Let's do the Dallas Penn Combat Jack Show. He's like, no, it's going to be the Combat Jack Show. And he pushed me in front of him, and then it became the Combat Jack Show.
Man.
So if it weren't for Dallas Penn, I wouldn't be doing this.
Why has Dallas not rocked with the show the entire time?
Dallas has to do his own thing.
Okay.
Dallas is unbridled genius.
Did you understand that he had to do his own thing the entire time?
I always knew, but I just never knew when.
Mm-hmm.
He was, and you know, Dallas. My history with Dallas is Dallas has quit the show like 3-4 times.
Yeah.
And always left me kind of like, fuck, you can't do this to me. You know? And the last time he did it, I was like, I'm good. Like, I really got to the point where it was like, I'm good. Like, I had prepared myself. I had gotten the confidence and the legs and the track record where it was like, I'm good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But Dallas is you know, one of the sharpest minds that I've ever met. And then his knowledge of New York City.
Yeah.
His knowledge of black history. His mm-hmm. knowledge of things, like his knowledge of architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's a smart, his knowledge of breaking into cars. You know, his knowledge of, you know, polos and this.
By the way, that's the best, like, run of things that he knows. And then just, like, I love that you throw breaking in cars, like, just in there.
Because he used to break into cars. Yeah, I mean, he was a professional. I don't want to say professional. But he was a professional car thief, you know.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Dallas is amazing. Like, he's just all these worlds that you shouldn't be an expert at. He's that. You know, I love Dallas Penn, man. Like,
yeah.
And
I saw him the other night.
Yeah. The many iterations the Combat Jack Show has gone through, you've ended up, now you're on a pretty good streak with you and Premium Pete.
Yes.
You and Pete didn't always get along.
No.
Can you talk about that?
We're going through something right now.
Okay.
I mean, you know, because Pete wasn't supposed to be on the show.
Right.
And Pete forced his way onto the show, and I fought that for so many years. And then once Dallas officially left, it was like, it's me and you, Pete, and we just rocked. And
yeah.
So the past year and a half, it's been Pete and I.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that you say that he, I don't know if wasn't welcome would be like the right way to describe it. But
the thing was,
but yours always felt like basically like anybody who's in the room has a microphone.
Well, no. I think that's what everyone felt.
Right.
Yeah.
Everyone in the room felt they had access to the microphone.
Yeah.
But what I had sketched out was it was Dallas, myself, and A King, and whatever guests we had. Initially, mm-hmm. we didn't have guests. So,
yeah.
You know, as we opened up the format to having guests, it was us three. NY Delight at the time, who sure. was one of our co-hosts.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that was it.
And then DJ had, Ben Hameen.
Right? Ben Hameen asked me one day, he's like, can I DJ on your show? I was like, sure. And I'm like, motherfucker, stay on the fucking turntables. Get off the mic.
Yeah. And then you had Matt Raz.
I actually pushed. I pushed Matt Raz because he was just so, his voice was just so in contrast to all the other voices that I thought that added. And then, you know, Just Blaze was like, yo, dude, Just Blaze. Can I be on the show? I was like, what?
Yo, you had a whole collection.
Gene Gray. That was, we went through this whole.
It's just like your own, like, just crew. Yeah, I mean, you guys
it's like
Wu-Tang.
A Simpsons episode. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, I mean, I think that's, you know, I look forward to finding my groove, and then I look forward to changing that groove.
Yeah.
You know, consistently, because, you know. I mean,
it's the same
with times
us. Yeah, we know that too. Yeah.
You guys
know. I mean, look, once times do change, right. And like,
and you're not going to stop because shit changes.
No, we describe ourselves.
No, we're
going to
stop because once something becomes popular, then we stop doing it.
Yeah, we're like the Buddhists who like paint with sand and then blow it away because it's all about the process. Yeah, that's who we are.
That's
you
who
know?
You guys yeah, are. You know? It's too hot right now. Let's move.
I know. Yeah.
I mean, basically every single time that we've done like anything that's become popular.
Yeah.
Like the sketches. The
why is that?
I think it's a fear of success.
I don't know. Really? What is it? No. Honestly, I think it's just to stay ahead of the curve.
Right. That's hard to do.
It is.
Man.
And by the way, we never wanted to do like sketches forever. And the cool thing now is like if we get stopped on the street or people see us in an elevator or a train or something like that, and they're just like, "Yo, I think your sketches were the best thing you ever did." Or other people were like, the MTV interviews, those are the best things you ever did. Or people were like, yo, your music, that's the best thing you ever did. Like, do more of that.
Right.
And, like, that's cool for us. Like, that different people can like different things.
But
like,
you guys haven't stopped, though.
No.
Like, you guys continue to move. And that's the most important thing.
Yeah,
you guys have to continue. You have to continue moving.
Also, see, we're a lot alike in that we're very persistent. We're very focused and determined. And, like, we could never stop. We could never stop moving forward.
Right.
Because, like, if we did, like, we're done.
It's done.
You know? And we still got to go down to, like, see our relatives at Thanksgiving, you know? And, like, have some sort of answer as to what we're doing.
Yeah, what are you guys doing?
You're so successful in all these iterations. You've had so many amazing guests. The Ice-T episode was legendary.
Ice-T, yeah.
Your Just Blaze and Damon Dash confrontation was
oh my God.
Unforgettable.
Oh, my God.
Kevin Gates 1 and 2.
Kevin, did you like part 2?
I haven't listened yet.
It's, you know, I like Kevin Gates.
Yeah.
And
He just got married.
He just got married. And there's something hypnotizing about the dude. Like, he just pulls me into his world.
Yeah.
And I just really, I want to figure him out. Like, and he allows me that room to try to figure him out. So it's kind of like this weird dance that Kevin and I have that I'm really grateful to have because I didn't know who the fuck Kevin Gates was a year ago.
You booked him on your thing.
The label. They were like, this is one of those rare instances where the label was like,
they were right.
Can you do a favor for us? And I was like, yeah, fuck it.
Wow.
So I was kind of like, just like I prepared like probably like the least I ever prepared for an interview.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wait a minute, this dude
is fascinating.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
And that became, it wasn't supposed to be an episode on its own. And it became an episode on its own.
Do you like his music?
I like his music. I do like his music.
Okay.
I mean, I
very much like his music.
Yeah.
He's charismatic. Mm-hmm.
Isn't it funny, by the way, for people who don't think that like showing your personality and going on shows like this or doing funny sketches or whatever, what have you, that helps you sell yourself?
Because it depends on who you are.
There's a lot of people who are afraid of it because they don't have that.
No, I know, but for me as a consumer, there's a lot of times where I'll watch an interview or like someone will sit here and I'll be like, you know what? I like you so much. I want to like give you that second look.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But not everybody gets that.
No, that's
not fair. Everybody gets it, and not everybody has it. I mean,
being so transparent
is not for everybody.
Right.
You got a lot of people that are clamoring for the limelight and the microphone and this platform, but who the fuck are they?
Right.
Like other than just being thirsty for the limelight.
Who is the most surprising person to reach out because you've gotten to this level now? Who are like, you know what? I want to be on that show.
So this is true story. I always knew that I wanted LL on the show, but I was like, how do you get LL? And then about a year ago, had a vivid dream. And I remember waking up and I said, honey, I'm going to interview LL Cool J. Right? I just.
Mescaline, yeah.
No more mescaline. Say no to drugs, man.
It's a rhyme. Mescaline is, you know.
So I had been reaching out to his PR and we were going back and forth. And then last year we were at A3C.
Yeah.
And his PR hit me and was like, yo, LL's in Atlanta. He wants you to interview him right now. But, you know, when you're at these conferences and these festivals, there's so much shit going on.
Right.
And I'm so focused on this and focused on that. I was like, there's no fucking way I can interview LL this weekend. No disrespect to LL, but this is LL. And so after three, they were bugging me to interview LL. And I was like, at a certain point, I was like, respectfully, like, I can't do LL while we're down in Atlanta. And a couple of months later, he was in town. But LL really wanted to be on the show. And
that's
I was like, yo.
That's really great.
Yeah.
Does he listen to your podcast? Do you know?
I think he had, you know, the Chuck
D. He's aware of it.
The Chuck D episode really broke ground for that generation of legends.
Yeah.
Because it was like, oh, shit, it's this other shit going on.
Right.
And Chuck's talking because Chuck is hard to have access to.
Sure. Mm. No, but, and I think what's really cool is that you've not only, you can get the Kevin Gateses and you can get the Chuck D's.
Yeah.
Like, you're not just doing, like, no one can pin you in one corner.
Dude,
Norman Lear is the better.
Norman Lear.
Yeah.
The hip-hop cop.
Hip-hop cop, Corey Pegues. You know, our next episode, well, it's going to be, but is Lisa Evers.
Oh, dope. Oh, cool.
And the reason why I wanted to...
you guys already recorded it, right? I saw a picture with you guys.
We recorded it. So, Lisa, to me, is an amazing story because we know her as this Fox 5 reporter and we know her as
Street Soldiers,
pioneer Street Soldiers, but you know, she did such a great job of kind of like having people forget her past as Lisa Sliwa, wife of Curtis Sliwa, co-leaders of the Guardian Angels.
Yeah, right. I had no idea.
Like that whole, like, if you go back, there's not much footage on her, but if you go back to, if you look at Lisa Sliwa, there's her. She was wild, dude, like on the Morton Downey Jr. show back in the 80s, or running around with like a young, wild Howard Stern. And like, she really had this like zero tolerance for crime. She was really outspoken and really brutal with regard to the Central Park Five. And just seeing her do this. So I had to get that story.
Man. The Jessica Rosenblum episode was fantastic.
It changed my life. Like that, I swear to God, it changed my life.
Why?
Because I remember that was one of those periods where things were changing. I think I had just lost Dallas Penn from the show, and I was like, what's going on? Am I falling off? You know, there's always that voice, like, are you falling off?
Sure.
And so she came on the show, and I was going through this period where I was not getting the guests that I wanted. Like, I was like, my batting average sucked.
Okay.
And I was like, did I lose it? You know? And so we had Russell on, and he had mentioned how Jessica had opened up the doors for him in the downtown scene. And I was like, well, let's get Jessica. I was like, you know, sometimes you have those guests. I don't know if I'm one of those guests. I was like, yeah, we'll settle for you. Mm-hmm. So she was a settled guest, I think, at the time. And then just, she was so brilliant. And she told me, I asked her, what did she credit her success to? And she said that, you know, Chris Lighty used to always tell her, whatever's going on around you, stay in your lane and master your lane. And I was like, this is so, it's so important that I hear this right now, because shit is changing. And I'm looking at other, I was looking at everybody else's lane. Like trying to figure out what am I going to do?
Is this post-complex?
Post-complex, yeah. Because I think, you know, I think the reason why I was also in this state is because coming off that high of the Complex show, it was like, I got to find another one.
Yeah,
I got to
right.
find this.
Yeah.
I got to find that. I got to do a live show. So I was looking at what everybody else was doing and not what I was doing. And
right.
It really stuck with me. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to turn down all the noise, tune everything out, and just stay in my silo.
Dope.
And then last year ended up being an amazing year for us.
Well, let's talk about this real quick.
Yeah.
You started a podcast network.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, I mean, talk about like just levels.
So I really credit all of that to my partner, Chris Morrow.
Mm-hmm.
So when things were kind of going shaky with PNC, when I was an online radio show, Twitter's amazing because I would just talk to Twitter and people would answer. And so Chris Morrow, amazing guy. So Chris is like the ghostwriter, not the ghostwriter, but he's the right. He's a several times New York Times bestseller list mm-hmm. for all the books he's written with Russell. He's got another book coming out on becoming a vegetarian.
Hmm.
So he's got that angle covered. But he's also the producer for the syndicated arm of the Breakfast Club.
Right.
So mm-hmm. he knows radio.
Right.
But he's been a student of the podcast game. His whole thing when we met was like, online radio shit is cool, but podcast is where it's at. So yeah. when I left PNC, he used to, I don't know if I could talk about this. Anyway.
Yeah.
So I had access to a very important person's studio.
Yeah.
And we just converted the show into podcast. So as we were building our relationship, he was like, let's build a network. And we had tried other shows, Sneaker Fiends, the show with Jazz Fly, and Reality Check. And then we discovered, I don't want to say we discovered, but we came across Kid Fury.
Right, right, right.
And I thought, and then Crystals. And I thought it was really cool because at the time, because we played a pause game,
right.
you know, we're getting a lot of flack for being like quasi-homophobic and the whole nine. I was like, yo, let's find someone that will throw that off so that we're not stuck in that, you know, that
that's like Odd Future.
exactly. And then we didn't know this guy would become the flagship show.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, how do you connect with Tax?
Tax, I think, was both a Kid Fury and a Charlamagne call.
Okay.
They saw his heat and his
on Twitter,
and they were like, that dude.
Yeah.
So,
but you hadn't met him.
I hadn't met him.
Nor had you heard like what he sounds like.
No, but
he's so good.
I'll tell you, we're really fortunate, man, because it's a really organic, very loose relationship. But Charlamagne has been really instrumental in helping us, you know, find talent. So he's the one that was like, you got to fuck with Tax.
Yeah.
And then Kid Fury was like, you got to fuck with Tax. And we were like, we got to fuck with Tax. And that was a gamble because, like, this motherfucker was, like,
wild.
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 But, you know, I can tell you, I love that dude, man, because he's so genuine.
Yeah.
He's new to the game. He's only been in this blog game, I mean, in this podcast game since February. So going from February 0 to 60, he's now on Uncommon Sense. So, I've seen him struggle with how do I walk away from this street life and really embrace this new world. How do I not fuck this up? And which blows my mind, the women love him.
Well, yeah, like they do.
He I was like, Tax, don't fuck around, my dude. Like, I was like, honey, what is it about Tax? She's like, nah, he's got it. Like, he's the bad boy that girls want to be with.
Mm-hmm.
So he's become this, like, you know, this sex symbol.
His
like,
Memphis Bleak episode
was
great. His Styles episode, just like solid. You're getting a different point of view.
And you know, so, you know, our advertisers are blown away with Tax because they're like, he needs to go into history books for bringing the medium, the podcast medium,
to the streets.
The streets. Like the Combat Jack show is kind of highbrow to like some of his audience. And to me, that's just amazing.
Yeah. Would you be open to, and is it a possibility for you to get Papoose on?
I have reached out to Papoose.
Because for the people who don't know.
Several times.
They're butting up heads.
Okay, so this was a learning experience. Like, I guess earlier on in my podcast career, I let loose on Papoose. And it was one of those rare instances where you're not expecting that to go viral. It went super viral to the point where it was like, I got some calls from some very serious people like, yo, just lay low.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't like that, you know. And, you know, at the time I thought it was genius what I was saying, but I really discovered really the responsibility we have. mm-hmm. when you have a platform and when you have a voice, because you can say some really hurtful things mm-hmm. that could really just disrupt not only your safety, but the livelihood of somebody else. So, you know, morally, mm-hmm. like I look back and it's like it's fucked up. And it's not coming from a perspective of like being afraid or I'm just owning up. It's fucked right. up that I went in on Papoose like that. Mm-hmm. And so I've reached out to his people, like not just, you know, for this to be like a hit episode or for the sensational aspect of it. It's like, I want to talk to the dude. Sure. I want to apologize to the dude. And I think it would be a great, just getting to know who Papoose
sure.
is.
Yeah.
I think
you give him that platform.
Interview, yeah. but it hasn't happened.
And that's his right too.
And that's his right too. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, you know, he doesn't take disrespect too lightly. And I respect that, but yeah. I still want to have a conversation with him face to face. Hopefully, you know, in front of the microphone so that we could really just have a really great conversation, man.
Sure. Does young Reggio say growing up, you know, going to elementary school, have any idea that this is the life you're going to live? A commentator, conversationalist.
No. But one of my aunts tells me, like, she really doesn't know what I do. She doesn't understand this podcast thing, but she sees.
Join the club.
She sees me doing, like, these, you know, these public speaking engagements. And she's like, listen, when you were three, we would be on a public bus. And whoever was sitting in our proximity, you would start interviewing them. And I always knew that you would do something interviewing people. And I don't have any recollection of
it. But how great is that, though?
Yeah, and I guess it kind of affirms, like, you know, I don't want to sound too hokey, but I really, like, having different careers and having to push and fit and squeeze, like, this, it feels so great to be in a career that's pulling me mm-hmm. as opposed to pushing. And it really makes me, I have this awareness that at this point in my life, I'm really doing my life's work.
That's awesome.
I'm really doing something that I don't complain about, something that I really love, something that I know inherently I'm the best at what I do.
Yeah.
And like I say that.
Well, present company excluded. You know?
I mean, no, but we don't do the same thing.
No.
You know, we do different things. But at what I do, I mean, I'm in my lane and I'm the happiest that I've ever been.
That's great.
So, you know, it lends credence to what she said about, you know, you'd always, you know, she knew I was always going to do this because it's something. I believe if you do something as a child endlessly and you have a passion for it, that's what you were meant to do mm-hmm. as an adult.
Don't you see this as a natural extension of, like, being a lawyer, though?
Of
like,
course.
Yeah, just, like, drawing information out of people?
Drawing information, examining, cross-examining, mm-hmm. the research, the reading, you know, facts and fact-checking and just trying to read body language and trying to pull out as much information as possible.
Yeah.
You know, I do this, you know, I've been speaking now at colleges, and mm-hmm. there's this one real-life story I have of a friend of mine, pardon me, Cesar Chivetta. And Cesar trained to become a classical conductor. He wanted to conduct orchestras, classical orchestras.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets out of school and he realizes that's not the easiest fucking job to find.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sends resumes out with dreams of conducting in China, Russia, all over South Africa, all over the world. Nothing. So about a year or so after just struggling, he finds a job as a painter painting houses. Mm. So he's like, how far away can you be from being a conductor and painting houses? So he's depressed, but he never gives up. Eventually, he starts conducting. He conducts in China, Russia, South Africa. He had an opportunity to conduct in front of the late, great Nelson Mandela.
Wow.
But the first performance he had, he gets up on the stage and he starts conducting, and he realizes that his stroke is immensely stronger and a lot more powerful and adds more depth to his performance.
Pause.
And he realizes, pause, stroke.
Yeah. Stroke, yeah,
good
yeah,
pause.
Yeah.
And he realizes that those muscles have been developed through all of those years
painting.
Of painting houses. So I really believe there are no wasted moments, man.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
Combat Jack, Reggio Say. Yes. Man, we really appreciate
Thank
you coming.
You. Yeah. I really appreciate
and coming with
dinner.
Gifts.
Yeah, you brought cookies, man.
Come on, man. You got to be internet. You guys got to be gracious, man. Where's your fucking humility? Who raised you? Come on, man. Let's bring some class to the game.
Shout out to your parents for raising you right.
No, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, where can people follow you on Twitter?
At @combat_Jack. But you can find me at the Combat Jack Show on iTunes, on SoundCloud. Has been a great partner. Stitcher. Just look us up. Google me. Use your Googles, you bastards.
Find Combat Jack at Sky Barn up in Syracuse.
Yo. Sky Barn, high on mescaline. Yeah.
57th Street Combat Jack.
Yeah. Internets don't do drugs. I did that so you wouldn't have to go through that.
Yo. No, but it got you into college.
No, right? Got me into law school.
Yo.
Mescaline.
Mescaline got you into law school.
I just hope I don't get my dean in trouble.
Yo. Thanks, Reggie.
Thank you, guys.